This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Hello, and welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeline Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, nervous, timid goth boys versus manic pixie dream girls. How a single trope shapes narrative preference.
Okay, so that was a mouthful.
I'm so impressed that I didn't start laughing halfway through that one. So there is no other way around the term. And to be fair, the nervous, timid goth boys is kind of a coined term anyway.
Yeah.
I've borrowed it from a blog post that I read, because it seemed to fit what I wanted to say.
Yeah.
But the manic pixie dream girl trope has been a long-standing trope for, I don't know, probably decades, but it was officially recognised as a trope within the last sort of 10 years,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah. I'm trying to think. The first time I really came across that kind of thing was probably through Scott Pilgrim versus the World.
Yeah.
And then suddenly I was very, very conscious of it everywhere.
After that, it was that kind of smashed mirror effect where it usually reflected back at you everywhere.
Yeah, absolutely.
Kind of thing. So anyway, this episode, how did it come about? I think the thing was, it's something you said in a previous podcast a long time ago now about manic pixie dream girls.
Yeah.
And I'd noticed the trope, obviously, but it hadn't really bothered me. Because I think I'd already made that divorce of church and state in terms of certain types of speculative fiction.
Yeah.
And my brain. My brain should be divorced from many things, in fairness. You know, nobody's going to disagree with that. So it was that. And then this other sort of type of character just kept popping up for me. And the two were sort of comparing themselves in my head. And I just thought it might be interesting to talk. And then the more I thought about it, the more sort of popped up.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like maybe you were looking at similar things without me knowing about it. So.
Yeah. I've got to admit, I haven't been thinking about it recently. But it is something that I have come back to time after time. And I usually end up coming back to it around this time of year. Because I'm talking to my students about it when it comes to sort of developing character and things like that. So the start of semesters is always when we start talking about the developing of character and the particularly the manic pixie girl starts cropping up a lot as we talk about, you know, influences in our own writing and things like that. So it's definitely something which kind of is continuously ticking over in my mind. So I'm really glad that we're talking about it today, because as you've said, we've mentioned it in previous episodes, but we've never really kind of focused in on it.
Yeah, definitely. And it's one that's well worth unraveling. We'll go into more detailed analysis of the two tropes as we've set them out.
Yeah.
But just as a brief introduction, what do we mean by manic pixie dream girl? What do we mean by nervous, timid goth boy? So I'll tell you what, I'll take nervous, timid goth boy. And if you would like to take manic pixie dream girl, and we'll obviously go into a bit more detail a bit later with examples. If you're happy, since you talked to your students about it anyway, you should be well up for this.
Okay. All right. So the manic pixie dream girl. There are several shades to this kind of character, but in essence, she is there completely in order to help a male character kind of live a little bit. So usually you have the male sort of love interest. He's usually depressed, or withdrawn, or, you know, socially awkward or things like that. He's a broody character, and he meets this girl who basically kind of introduces him to life and gives him happiness and sort of pushes him to kind of really fulfill himself and find his own path and his own way. So that's her function. She as a character is usually very quirky. Stereotypically, when she has certain type of hair, so she'll have short, very quirky, you know, brightly coloured hair. Everything she does is for him. She's never really kind of pursuing her own thing. She never really changes. And she is in essence, basically, as the word describes, as the name describes, rather, she is this, you know, this perfect woman for this male character. She's there to prop him up and give him everything that he needs. And very often in those kinds of narratives, he's not actually giving her anything. Yeah. She's this well of wisdom and inspiration and all of these kinds of things. But she herself doesn't really change at all. So
that's a good summation of the Manic Pixie Dream Girl trope. Nervous, tense. Oh, we could have nervous, tense goth boy. Nervous, timid goth boy. This, as I said, this isn't a real term. This is kind of just coined so we can put it against the Manic Pixie Dream Girl. Basically, these characters are subversions of the default narrative. So they are subversions of your stereotypical white male, all-American, good old boy, sort of boy next door, hero for the hero's journey type character that you get. Who might face a few trials and things, but never really ever has to, confront issues within their own morality. So they don't, though within the default narrative, those characters don't change much. So the nervous, timid goth boy is different in the sense of that they're quite often awkward. They don't look a certain way, they don't act a certain way. They're often quite sensitive. They're the antithesis of the Manic Pixie Dream Girl because they care very much about what's going around them, even though they have difficulty expressing it. And it's just a really interesting way of using a character trope and setting a male lead that actually opens up the narrative to an equal partnership with a female lead, or even for the female lead to like subtly take over. So that's a really... Mm-hmm. broad definition, and we can drill down a bit more with that one, but it's an interesting trope. It's almost the reverse of the Manic Pixie Dream Girl in some respects.
Okay, so now that we've got them established, what we mean by these things, and again, I do want to say that obviously it is a lot more complicated than that. Both of these kind of versions of characters will have lots of different shades and lots of different, ways that they're interpreted. But that's the kind of the basic generalized explanation for them. So now we've got that established.
Yeah, it's how do they shape a narrative preference? And this sort of leads on to a little bit of my theory, but I'm going to repeat a conversation I had with Alan before this podcast because it was very funny.
Mm-hmm.
Alan, before every episode of a podcast I do, he'll say, "Oh, what's it about today?" Because he is genuinely interested, and also he's a little bit of a sticky beak. So he's like, "So what are you talking about? Am I missing a good conversation?" Because he's an absolute sucker for a good discussion on something. So I told him the title of the podcast and he went, "Is there even a question?" And I was like, no, not really, and wandered off. And then I sort of did 5 steps back and walked back into his study and went, "Hang on a second, when you said, is there even a question, are you coming down on the side of the Manic Pixie Dream Girl?" And he went, "Well, duh, yeah, obviously." And I went, "Ooh, you've just proved my theory." And he's like, "No, dude, seriously. What you do with the nervous, timid goth bloke that you've just talked about, you take a load of black candles and you set them up at strategic intervals up a cliff face, and you light them and you go all the way to the edge of the cliff, and then you just toss over the complete works of Byron and, you know, a mint edition vinyl copy of Bauhaus." You said, "And that's how you get rid of these nervous, timid goth blokes." And I'm like, "You've totally just proved my theory." So from that very small pool of one person... which really doesn't constitute a big enough sampling ground for any sort of theory. My theory is that the Manic Pixie Dream Girl is actually a creation to favour a male-led or male-preferred narrative.
Mm-hmm.
Which makes a lot of sense if you think about the way Madeline just described it. Everything is about the bloke, and she acts as a muse for him to find his own happiness.
Yeah.
Whereas, as we've said with the nervous, timid goth bloke, actually, that is about opening up the narrative to new possibilities.
Yeah.
Broadly. And it can be a path for the average girl to have an extraordinary adventure and tell her story without ever resorting to being this manic pixie, not like the other girls type person.
Yeah, absolutely. So
thus is my theory. And there you see, obviously, Alan went... The thing was, I actually walked away thinking, well, he must see which one's the better one in storytelling terms. But he's like, no, I'd much rather hang out with a manic pixie dream girl. It's like, of course you would, because you're a bloke and they're designed to appeal to you. The defense rests.
No, I would tend to agree with that theory. Obviously, different people are going to come into it from different angles, but certainly, yeah, the manic pixie dream girl, she can appear in stories which are for girls. But again, she's there to prop up the male character. Not the female. It's not her story. It never is. So, and I think there's also that's actually something which is worth mentioning, is that if it is her story, then she may have qualities which are a manic pixie dream girl type, but she herself isn't actually a manic pixie dream girl. But we'll go into that in a little bit.
Yeah, definitely. I think next on our list was sort of looking at, you know, the pros and cons of these different tropes. And, you know, both of them have got pros and cons.
Yeah.
Just one of them's got more pros and less cons, in my opinion.
Yeah.
But, you know, Madeline and I are obviously both coming from the position of the manic pixie dream girl is not a great trope and you should try avoid using it. And obviously there are other perspectives than ours. We just happen to really agree on this one.
Yeah.
So bearing that bias in mind, we will try to be sort of relatively level about the whole thing. But I think the thing that really strikes it about for the manic pixie dream girl for me is the way it feeds into the not like the other girls trope.
Yeah, absolutely. It really does. This girl is meant to be set apart from the rest of the crowd, and you know that's in the way that she holds herself, in the way that she does certain fashion. And usually, actually, she won't really have kind of... You won't really see her with her own sort of friends. She'll just be doing her own thing. And she'll be really super comfortable with doing her own thing and be deeply philosophical about what she's doing and things.
Yeah, I'd even go so far as to say that you very rarely see this character with any female friends.
Yeah.
She's someone... all the boys think is really cool. She's really independent. She's into edgy, different stuff or very retro stuff. She's unconventionally beautiful. She has this quirky style, as you've said. Or she's got these really weird... she sort of has abilities that she's never really had to work for. She's got a natural competence at something or several somethings. Or she doesn't have competence at anything. She's just good at being really cool and a bit of a wild child.
Yeah. And I should point out that each of these qualities individually are not a bad thing. And having all of those qualities together is not necessarily a bad thing either. You can still have a very good character who is quirky and who doesn't hang out with girls and stuff like that. And, you know, that's fine. It's the fact that she is idealized. Yeah. She's not a real person. She doesn't actually act like a real person at all. And she's an idealized version of what kind of the male character or the male gaze wants in this kind of narrative. And the problem is that because she's so idealized, she's kind of hollow. She doesn't have her own goals. She doesn't have her own life. She's sort of like a never-ending inciting incident.
Yeah, that's fair. I mean, and the problem with that, obviously, is that you've got this character who is a blank. She's a paper doll who the male, and you nearly always see her through the male character's gaze initially, his perspective. You very rarely see her through her own, except for some certain bits of YA fiction, I think.
Yeah.
And it's just a case of, the weird thing is with a YA fiction is even if you're seeing things through her point of view, she seems to be seeing herself through a double filter whereby she's seeing herself as she is seen through the male character's point of view.
Yeah.
It's very, very bizarre. And the problem with that is that this paper doll character can be anything. Anything that the male character wants to project onto her.
Mm.
And then she just sort of becomes it by default. And not so subtly, that sort of perpetuates the message that women are just mirrors for male desires.
Yeah.
And there's a big problem. I mean, surely Madeline and I don't have to explain what's wrong with that one. I hope.
And again, I've got to emphasise that it's not about the qualities that she has which make her a manic pixie dream girl. It's about the things that she lacks. That's the real issue that I have with it.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. And as we said, you know, there's very little character growth. She doesn't seem to have her own desires. Everything is about being devoted to, even if she's really sort of offish and sort of do whatever you like and I'm the cool girl, you can't really quite acquire kind of thing.
Yeah.
All of it is about the male character journey.
Yeah.
But his happiness, not her own.
Yeah.
It
also feeds into the trope of the woman's role being to take care of the man.
Yeah, supporting cast.
Yeah, and absolutely, supporting cast. But even beyond that, just this kind of this innate perceived role, which is that troubled men need, you know, deserve a woman to look after them, to unload all of their problems on her. And it's never really exchanged. She doesn't often unload problems on him. And if she does, it's very brief. You know, it's just part of her quirky character of, oh, you know, my dad left when I was little. And, you know, she's not dwelling on any of these things, but he's allowed to brood. And she's allowed to kind of offload all of his stuff onto her over and over and over again. And it's not an equal partnership at all. And that's actually also very dangerous, because these women who do appear in female fiction as well are kind of framed as the perfect kind of girls. And in a lot of ways, they also do appeal to a lot of female readers, because they're like, actually, I'm a little bit quirky. I'm a little bit different. I kind of like this character. I like the style. I like her, you know, her confidence and stuff like that. And
their
I see...
son, I would like to be liked like this without the hang-ups.
Yeah,
kind
exactly.
Of thing.
So, you know, they see all of these things. And then the problem is that they also see this idea that, oh, so she's just dealt with her problems. That's it. She's just got them inside of her. She doesn't complain about them because she doesn't need to complain about them. She's got it. And I'm like, that's not actually great, because as we've said, she doesn't seem to have any female friends. She doesn't seem to have any network to kind of to deal with her own stuff. Or even have any stuff. And it's a really dangerous kind of idea to suggest that this idealized girl, it's not that she doesn't have problems. She does have problems. It's all part of her quirky nature. But she just swallows it.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And it is, as you say, you can't have a basis for any actual sort of relationship, whether it's friendship or something more, there. Because if one person's the one doing all the sharing, the other person is just being the person they think that person wants or needs.
Yeah.
That, you know, that is something waiting to go horribly wrong. And the problem, it's no exaggeration to say this is then something that gets carried forward into real life. This is genuinely what happens. You get a bloke who is perhaps a bit shy, a bit awkward, someone who genuinely doesn't fit the default male narrative of what society says he should be.
Yeah.
But there's this great girl who'll fix him. And you'll notice that in a lot of these, particularly YA things, and some of the films as well, where this manic pixie dream girl, she is, if you want to be really blunt about it, she's kind of out of his league.
Yeah.
Because she's so together and, you know, she's very, very attractive and she knows the score. Everything is kind of together, you know, she's plugged into life. He's not. Now, people who are really together don't generally go looking for messes to fix.
Yeah.
You know, there's got to be something more going on there. And nine times out of ten with these films and books and things, there is not more going on there. This is somebody who's desperately saying, please fix me, please make me as cool as you, without realizing that that's what they're doing.
Yeah.
And they're projecting what they think this other person is without ever bothering to get to know them. And this has been happening in real life for centuries. And here's a little example for you. Obviously Dante, creator of the Divine Comedy.
Yeah.
Writing it back in the 1600s, his muse, a woman he had only met three times in his life.
Yeah.
Beatrice Portinari, who died when she was 24. This is another manic pixie dream girl trait.
Yeah.
The male obviously doesn't know her very well. And then she dies young, tragically. And that's when the mirror fractures and they realise that this wasn't a great muse person. This was someone who was not together, who had their problems, and they just ignored them. But he said of her, he called her La Gloriosa Donna della Mia Mente, which is the glorious lady of my mind. And I think at the time he didn't realise that what he was saying was that it was supposed to be a tribute to his muse, but what he didn't realise he was saying, quite ironically, was the fact that he'd made this woman up and didn't have a clue who she was.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
And there's been lots of them. I mean, if you think about all the women that Percy Bysshe Shelley has written poems about, for example, even Byron, you know, she walks in beauty like the night of cloudless climes and starry skies, and all that's best of dark and bright meet in her aspect and her eyes. It's like, have you actually had a conversation with her?
Yeah. And it's the absolute origin of the manic pixie dream girl, is actually this perfect woman who is perfect because actually they've only seen a very surface level of her, and haven't had to deal with anything underneath. Like, again, really disturbing. It's just this perfection is you know, only this nice stuff right at the top, which I can observe after, you know, a very, very short amount of time. And I don't have to deal with anything underneath. I don't want any of that stuff. And then what happens is that kind of thing is sort of just sort of clumped all together, and they said, now here I have an actual character who's actually part of a longer narrative rather than just a, you know, a brief interaction. And that is when it starts to get weird.
I mean, put it this way, you know, you've included a manic pixie dream girl when you have talked about the colour of the character's hair because it's unusual.
Yeah.
And then you haven't actually given her hopes and dreams and neuroses of her own.
Yes.
anyway, some examples, and some of these sort of fit bits of the trope rather than the entire trope itself. There aren't many examples where it's a case of, no, this is the trope, full stop.
Yeah.
Kind of thing.
I am just going to say, actually, just very briefly, and I know it's very hard to do, let's actually look at some of the positives of
Dream Girl. We almost came close to touching it, and then I sort of, my brain filed it away as having been good. They're fun. They are fun characters. Isn't it fun to hang out with someone who's a lot of fun, who's plugged into life and has no hang-ups?
Yeah. They...
Sorry.
It's okay. They are fun characters. And in terms of actually role models, there are some good qualities about the manic pixie dream girl. The first one is that she is not, she's not being affected or provoked by the society around her.
Yeah.
So she is unapologetically herself. She's confident in what she is, and she's embraced her, you know, her weirdness or her quirks and things like that as part of her. She's not going to change to fit in. And actually, in the end, that has actually caused a level of admiration, because she's just comfortable. So I think that that's very cool. I think it's also nice that we're moving away from this very strict narrative of people should be X, Y, Z. And obviously we're doing the same on a different level, but it's nice to say, you know, play around with your hair, do something a little bit fun, you know, allow yourself to be childish, allow yourself to be philosophical, and allow yourself to be confident as well. And I think it's also quite nice that we're moving away from that narrative of, truly interesting people are very troubled or very sad.
Yeah, definitely. I completely agree with that. And honestly, there is nothing wrong with having wish fulfillment characters in fiction as well, as long as you're aware that they're wish fulfillment characters.
Yeah.
I mean, in fairness, romance novels have been doing the whole wish fulfillment male character,
yeah,
who's a bit brooding and a bit tortured, but the female comes along and saves him for years, and there's a reason it sells.
Yeah.
But I don't think anybody who reads romance then goes out and expects the men they meet to actually act like that.
No.
So it's a case of knowing where the line is, and the problem with this trope cropping up, obviously, in YA is the fact that you're still learning where the line is.
Yeah. And there seems to be some people who don't actually know where the line is.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. But yeah, they're fun characters. It's not a case of I'm offended. It's more a case of there are sometimes I think, can you please just give her a bit more actual character?
Yeah.
Yeah, so we were going to talk about a few examples. So you obviously mentioned Ramona Flowers from Scott Pilgrim.
Yeah.
At least I assume you're talking about Ramona Flowers.
Yeah, that's right.
Although, to be fair, you could be talking about Knives Chow as well.
Yeah, to be honest, yes. To be honest, it was a long time since I watched the movie and read the comics. All I know is that Scott is actually a really uninspiring character. He's actually kind of irritating.
He is. He's directionless.
Yeah.
And he's incapable of making a decision. He just happens to be very good at fighting.
Yeah.
But yeah, he's pretty much indifferent at everything else. And Ramona is this really cool chick with a past and, you know, the quirky, unconventional good looks and the hair and the style and the fuck you kind of attitude.
Yeah.
And he just sort of completely falls for her and cheats on his current girlfriend, who, to be honest, is kind of an avoidance project.
Yeah.
Because he had a bad breakup. In fact, all the girls in that are more or less the manic pixie dream girls of some kind, which really tells you a lot about Scott Pilgrim.
Yeah.
And how he is not mature enough to see them as anything else.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think in some respects, actually, the comic is in some ways actually dealing with the idea of the manic pixie dream girl, in that these characters are actually fighting against what he assumes about them and kind of pushing back against it a little bit. And I also remember in the film that, you know, you'd have these scenes with Ramona and Scott, and she just didn't seem to really like him at all.
No, she not especially bothered. I think there's even a point where he tries to make her more real by saying, look, I know you've dabbled in being a bitch so that you don't get hurt, mm-hmm. but this isn't what you're really like.
Yeah.
And she says, you don't know what I'm really like.
Yeah.
And she said, I don't know what I'm really like. And I think that's probably the truism of the film there, is a case of you genuinely have not got to know this person.
Yeah.
You don't, you know, the whole thing with the seven evil exes is very funny, but at the same time it's also a case of you haven't bothered to ask yourself any serious questions there.
Yeah. And it's the interesting thing is that literally they personify it perfectly by having Scott draw this stupid picture and showing his friend saying, do you know a girl with hair like this? When he's trying to find Ramona. And I was just there like, wow, this is...
Yeah, so I mean, I think the film is actually trying to deliberately or otherwise subvert a lot of that, because a lot of it is in the comics, isn't it?
Yeah. And it's so I do feel actually very much in particular that Ramona from the film adaptation is a little bit more of one. But as I've said, you know, there is actually there's more characterization in the comics, but it is actually perhaps also technically challenging the manic pixie dream girl idea, but it doesn't challenge it completely, because I think he still gets with her at the end.
Yeah, although there's an alternate where he actually ends up going back to Knives instead.
Yeah.
So, but again, that's not very much better, is
no,
it?
No, it isn't. Like, she really deserves better.
Definitely. So I kind of see the appeal, because at some point most blokes have been the awkward teenage boy who's very unsure of himself and doesn't know how to talk to girls, etc.
Yeah.
And having the idea that this cool girl might genuinely like them, even though she's pretending indifference, is very appealing.
Yeah.
I get that. That's the wish fulfillment thing. It's the way it's sort of packaged towards girls that's the problem, I think.
Yeah, absolutely.
I've got another example. Yeah. You haven't read The Belgariad by David Eddings, and a lot of it is, tongue in cheek about the classic fantasy hero's mm-hmm. journey. And they've probably dated a little bit. They're a little bit simplistic now. Put it this way, they started out being adult fantasy and now they've been marked down to the lower end of teen. So not because, you know, they're not well written, but just because it's decided that people can handle the themes and things much, much earlier on. I mean, I've seen middle grade children reading them quite happily.
Yeah.
I certainly did. And one of the characters is the love interest, Synedra. She is like the dryad princess. And I very nearly decked a boyfriend in university because we were talking about the Belgariad, as you do.
Yeah.
And he said, well, you kind of remind me of her. And I was like, hang on a minute, I remind you of who? He's like, you remind me of Synedra. And I just looked at him. He went, okay, I'm really sorry, but it's the hair. And that's the thing. She's this tiny sort of outspoken, sparky little creature who is supposed to be absolutely beautiful, but she has this massive abundance of red hair.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, I'm nothing like that person. I was like, oh my god, am I dating somebody who thinks I'm some sort of stupid fantasy trope? I was very annoyed. And he's like, okay, who would you prefer to be? And I'm like, do I have to pick someone from the Belgarian series? anyway, long time ago. And she's a fun character, that's the thing. But I'd even say she's probably a bit more complex than that.
Yeah.
But she is very much designed to be, if you think that she's raised to be a princess and she's supposed to be, you know, beautiful and tiny and precious and have a certain amount of magical ability, what have you, why on earth would she decide to marry someone who is basically a kitchen boy and who is absolutely filthy, who has been deliberately kept illiterate and filthy by his aunt so no one realizes he's the chosen one? And they're sort of, it's sort of kind of, they're nudged together constantly by the adults surrounding them. And he doesn't like her very much either. I mean, he fancies her a lot, but at the same time, he's kind of like, no, she's horrible to me. She's mean. And she only stops being mean when she realizes he's going to be king someday.
Yeah.
It's just, it kind of hits a lot of those tropes looking back. It's funny. It is very, very funny. But at the same time, I'm like, yeah, there's a lot of Manic Pixie Dream Girl going on there.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, I've got one which is going to sound a little bit surprising. But actually, there are weirdly enough two Manic Pixie Dream Girls in Fight Club. And one of them isn't actually a girl.
Okay.
So, the female love interest in Fight Club, played by Helena Bonham Carter. It is played by her, isn't it?
Yeah, you're talking about Marla.
Yeah, Marla. She is actually a little bit of a Manic Pixie Dream Girl. Now, she's obviously, she's not shiny and spanky and new. She's in a bit of a state herself. But she actually still kind of fulfills that role, and she has this relationship with Tyler, the character Tyler, where despite the fact that he keeps sort of being very abusive and sort of mixed with her, she does keep sort of coming back to him.
You're going to ruin the entire plot for someone who doesn't know what happens in that film.
Sorry, guys, but it's been around for ages, and if you haven't figured it out...
No, I see what you mean, and I think you're right. She fulfills the same role, because she's... The main character of Fight Club is trying to hit rock bottom, and this is a girl who's already done it. She's really genuinely done it.
Yeah.
Where she then deviates and where he starts to see her more as a real person, bearing in mind this is someone with serious psychiatric issues,
yeah,
who doesn't know it yet, is when she turns around and says, no, look, I like you. There's lots of things I like about you, but you have serious problems. You have serious, serious problems. You need help.
Yeah.
You need professional help. Someone who's hit rock bottom this badly and has a suicide attempt pretty early on in the film is turning around saying, oh, no, you need help way more than I do, and I'm not the person to give it to
yeah.
you. So, yeah, she is in the sense of he has projected what he thinks she should be
yeah.
onto her. And then you have that little departure. So yeah, I do kind of agree.
Yeah.
It's a case of the character has not been allowed to be
yeah.
what she is by the main character.
Exactly. So the other one is actually the character of Tyler himself, is a bit of a manic pixie dream girl for the narrator. So stick with me on this. Think about the way that the manic pixie dream girl kind of arrives usually in a narrative is that you have this character who is just very dissatisfied with life. They're really, really not doing well. And then they meet someone who's quirky and different and kind of, it's a little bit like a sudden ray of sunshine, or it's like a slap in the face. It's a bit of a wake-up call. And this person pulls them along on zany adventures and makes them reanalyze everything that they're doing and change the way that they consider everything they're doing. And start to sometimes act in a slightly crazy way.
Yeah.
Which must be said it might be happening in Fight Club.
There's no slightly yeah. about it in Fight Club.
Completely crazy way. Whilst being weirdly philosophical about it.
Yeah.
So
I
yeah.
Agree
so with that. Tyler. So Tyler is a bit of a manic pixie dream girl.
I mean, there is a very good reason that he's all about the main character.
Yeah, there is a very good reason, but you know, but it also really just goes on to add that whole idea of projecting the perfect person.
Definitely. We won't do too many more examples here because once we've explained it, you can see it. Obviously, you've got people like Kate Hudson in Almost Famous. You've got Brooke Shields' character in Weird Science, a film which has not really dated very well, in my opinion. In that one, you have two nerds who basically create the perfect woman for themselves, and she is all about them.
Yeah, you've got perfect... pretty much everything that John Green writes involves some kind of manic pixie dream girl. Or boy, sometimes it's a manic pixie dream boy.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think he's trying to subvert tropes, but not managing it terribly well a lot of the time.
Yeah.
So, there's lots of examples. We're going to go on to nervous, timid goth boys now, because otherwise we won't get to do a comparison.
Yeah.
While nervous, timid goth boys... once again, just a recap, this is about getting away from the default narrative of the strong male character who is almost always white and very attractive, etc.
Mm-hmm.
Generally quite well adjusted. And, you know, if man pain happens early on, then he sort of overcomes it through strength of will and being a good American, etc.
Yeah.
Basically, every hero in every movie and every book almost... written for the general consumption between sort of 1950 and 1980.
Mm-hmm.
And even after that, even now to some extent. So the nervous timid goth boy is kind of a challenge to the stereotype, because sometimes they can be more feminine in some of their attributes, or sometimes they're deliberately trying to look a little bit different, or they're expressing themselves through their appearance in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
Not in a way just to be quirky, but in a way because it fits them
yeah.
them better. It sort of challenges the ideas of attraction and romance, particularly in teen and young adult mm-hmm. speculative fiction.
Yeah.
And they tend to have loads of character. There tends to be a lot going on there. They are a bit of a mess, but they're not looking for anyone to fix them. They're keenly conscious of what's going on around them, and they're trying to work out things in their own heads, and quite often they're wrestling with their own morality quite a
yeah.
bit. They're very interesting in that respect, and them being like this opens up the narrative to them meeting somebody else who doesn't fix them but makes them start to question things in a different way.
Yeah.
This is a good point to mention Tim Burton. Not that I think he's a nervous, timid goth boy. Although I think maybe he might be just a little bit. But it's really, really interesting that almost all of his films, except the ones that are particularly adapted from a male biography type perspective, yes, they've got a particular gothic feel, and yes, he nearly always pulls in Helena Bonham Carter or Winona Ryder or Johnny Depp, and then he has Danny Elfman do the music, and the, you know, he only uses three colours, you know, black, white and grey, and occasionally a little splash of red. Yeah, they are very similar, but the stories are interesting, because even the ones that are very much, you know, they have male names, or the male characters' names as the title, and yet the films are almost always completely about the female character. So yeah. It's a reverse. It's really interesting. So,
Yeah, absolutely.
One of the... I have kind of a love-hate relationship with this film. I went through a phase of loving it as a teenager and then being a bit grossed out by it, and then sort of coming back to sort of, oh, yeah, it's a classic. I feel quite warm and fond about it. And that's Beetlejuice. And I still look at it and think, no, the actual character of Beetlejuice is just... Ugh. But he appears in sort of like a third of that film. It's titled after him, but the actual character of Beetlejuice, this malevolent sprite thing that can be summoned by saying his name three times, the story's not about him. The story is about Winona Ryder's teenage girl character, who is a bit gothic, and as she says, a bit strange and unusual. And it's about her coming to terms with the ghosts living in her house and her family not being able to see her. You know, making her a ghost as well, in the sense of they just don't notice their daughter because she doesn't fit in. And it's all about getting these two families to work together. And in that sense, it's a really lovely story.
I've never seen it, probably because Beetlejuice scares the living daylights out of me.
But yeah, so, I mean, you can't really call Beetlejuice a nervous, timid goth boy. He's definitely kind of a goth boy, but he's not... Not really nervous or timid. He's more sort of manic. He is definitely more manic. So if you can have a manic goth boy, then that's him. But he is there hardly at all. And, you know, having opened the entire narrative up, he sort of steps back for three quarters of it, so that this girl character, who's a lot more fragile than she thinks she is, can come forward and create the sort of family she actually wants.
Yeah.
So that's interesting.
That's a really interesting look at it. It's because obviously this is also the first time I've even heard this term, because you're coining it. But the more you talk about it, the more I'm like, oh yeah.
And that there are other examples as well. I haven't seen Edward Scissorhands for about 25 years. I was a massive fan. But Edward Scissorhands is classic, nervous, timid goth boy, you know, with scissors for hands and what have you. But again, he kind of steps back in his own narrative, and Winona Ryder, again, the girl next door character, takes a step forward and claims centre stage. So yeah, this is someone who, again, he's wrestling with his own morality and things. And, you know, Winona Ryder's character even provides the framing narrative of the grandmother telling the story to the children.
Yeah.
So that's interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. That film always kind of really annoyed me, though, because it was just maybe take the scissors off his hands.
I know, I think I was... Well, I don't think they didn't have any alternative for his hands. And it's kind of scissors or nothing. But yes, that was kind of...
I still feel like nothing might be better.
Yeah, and there is another problem I have with the scissors, but I'll come up to that in a bit. But yeah, it's... I didn't like
just
it.
Just unsharpen them?
Yeah, it was almost too weird for me. I know that's a strange thing for me to say, but that was almost too weird.
I mean, I guess all the idea is that it's also meant to be kind of... it's not necessarily meant to be taken literally.
No, it's a fairy tale.
Yeah. But it is very odd.
And okay, another one from my teen years. Batman Returns.
Yeah.
With Michelle Pfeiffer playing Catwoman, playing Selina Kyle. Mm-hmm. And yeah, okay, you got Batman in the title. and it's supposed to be sort of the second Batman film, but really that film for me is all about Selina Kyle, and Selina Kyle learning not to be a pushover and learning to claim power for herself, and in some respects sort of some sexual dominance as well. And yeah, she goes a bit crazy. I can't necessarily put a finger on what's an appeal for me in that film. It's not just the vinyl cat suit, I promise. But it,
are you sure?
Pretty sure. I think of the early Batman films, that was probably the best one. The one that came before felt unformed in terms of character dynamics, and the ones that came after just went a bit too far, and plus the female characters just became sex objects, whereas what Michelle Pfeiffer brought to Catwoman in that was really interesting. This was somebody who genuinely had a lot of rage because she'd been badly treated, and you know, it was justified. It was justified the way that she was aiming it. And even at the end of the film, when, you know, Bruce knows who she is and she knows who he is, because they've been doing this cat and mouse thing all the way through, or cat and bat as it is. Mm-hmm. And she sort of says, you know, I would love to come and live with you in your castle. I'm not that person anymore. I'm not the princess who can actually be rescued by a prince, by a handsome billionaire. I've seen and experienced too much. And she keeps her independence.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that a life of crime wielding a whip is the way to go, but you know what? She made that choice for herself.
It was her choice at the end of the day. Oh, dearie me.
Okay, the absolute, for me, pinnacle of the... These are all Tim Burton. I'm sure there are other examples. The absolute pinnacle of the nervous, timid goth boy is the 1990-something film Sleepy Hollow.
Yes.
And you've got Johnny Depp playing Ichabod Crane, and Christina Ricci playing Katrina Van Tassel, who is a quite a sweet person, a white witch. She comes from a family of witches. Ichabod Crane, in that, instead of going with Washington Irving's, you know, semi-satirical story of the Legend of Sleepy Hollow, they've actually put some genuine supernatural stuff in it. And Ichabod Crane comes from a family of witch hunters. He's become a constable in New York who actually investigates murders rather than just going for the nearest person. Oh, I guess we'll execute you then. Or we don't solve the crime because we didn't find the murderer holding a knife standing over the body.
So wrong place, wrong time.
I liked that because that was morality and science versus superstition and convenience. So that aspect of the character appealed to me. And then this is somebody who has put his father's religion and his father's superstition behind him because his father was a cruel man. And gone and out to Sleepy Hollow. That's where he gets sent to investigate. His superiors don't like him investigating. They want it solved nice and easily before tea time. So they send him out to Sleepy Hollow to investigate this headless horseman. And of course he thinks, nothing's happening. This is ridiculous. This is credulous locals. And I think on his way there, he sees the headless horseman. And lets out this high-pitched pterodactyl scream. It's like, okay, this isn't a case of I need to be convinced there is something very seriously wrong going here. So he's desperately trying to hold on to science. He's wrestling with his own sense of morality, because if science doesn't help him in this case, then maybe his father's patrician religion was actually correct, and he should assume that anyone with any ability towards witchcraft is in fact evil. And obviously he starts to remember things about his own mother. And there are bits of that film that are really dated now, I think. But the overall arc is actually still quite nice. And again, you've got someone, he's not supermanly, he doesn't get out his sword and start fighting the headless horseman. He allows Katrina Van Tassel to come to his rescue. This isn't someone who barrels in and solves things based on muscle alone. And I really appreciated that, particularly when it came out.
Yeah, absolutely. That's actually kind of sweet. I like that.
Is this one you haven't seen?
I haven't seen it. No, I've seen some of the new series, but obviously that's very different.
Yeah. I kind of like that as well. I think they were inspired there, certainly by the film. Because actually, in the story, The Legend of Sleepy Hollow, the original story, mm-hmm. he's basically just a music teacher who turns up on the off chance that someone will take him in for a couple of seasons and he'll get some food. And he tries to make off with the daughter of the house, and Brom Bones scares him off by pretending to be the Headless Horseman.
Yeah.
You know, it's a bit, it's entertaining, but as ghost stories go, it's a bit of a damp squib. It's actually not very scary. It's kind of like, oh, it was you all along.
That's a shame.
It is, really. You kind of want there to be a headless horseman.
You always want there to be a headless horseman.
Yeah, of course. Right. We haven't talked about the cons of this nervous, timid goth boy. And I think the con is that if it's not done correctly, under the guise of a more open, enlightened narrative, whereby mm-hmm. you're making space for two equal partners within even the female character taking over, and not having this toxic masculinity, because you've got the character being all sort of new man's even worse, sorry, being all sort of like non-conventional, that's what I'm trying to say, non-conventional male character, you can actually let some of the more insidious, subtle forms of misogyny seep through. And I'm thinking of things like, I loved these books, by the way, they're by Kelly Cray, and it's Nevermore, and it's basically the goth boy at school and the head cheerleader get paired up on an English literature project, and he wants to do Edgar Allan Poe. He's got a bit of an obsession about it, and she gets to know him and really likes him, and she genuinely starts really fancying him. He obviously really fancies her, but doesn't trust it because she's too good for him, kind of thing, because girls like her don't go for guys like him, etc., etc. Cute teen drama, which I have to admit I was really there for, because I read these books when I was 20-something, so I was over all that shit, and it was just really entertaining. So I was reading... I think I've still got the books, actually. But anyway, it goes from there, and then she realises there's something really weird about this Edgar Allan Poe stuff, in the sense of her literature partner keeps disappearing and losing time, and she starts having really weird dreams. And then it turns out that, you know, like the poem Lenore, the strange vampiric lady who comes to the narrator of the poem and draws him away into another world?
Yeah,
apparently this has been happening to the goth boy in that for some time, to the point where... The cheerleader girl, I can't remember her name, I'm sorry, has to find a way of getting into this Poe-esque world of nightmares in order to get the man that she's fallen in love with back.
It's almost a bit like Tamlin.
It is a little bit like that, but with you know, the horrible creatures like the Mask of the Red Death.
Okay, that sounds actually kind of epic, not gonna lie.
It is really good, and yet, what I will say, I was talking about sort of the subtle misogyny, he doesn't treat her very well, because instead of looking at her and going, oh, manic pixie dream girl kind of thing, because she's really not, she has her own agendas and what she wants, she goes against her father, who doesn't approve of this new boyfriend at all. He is constantly wrestling with his own self-doubt about being good enough for her, because he's come from a background where he's not valued at all. And he takes a lot of that out on her, and she just keeps coming back to him because she thinks she can reach him, and she can. And admittedly, he keeps getting abducted into this nightmare realm, so there's that to contend with as well.
Yes.
But I think it's one of those things whereby if it had been written 10 years later, they would not have had him acting in quite that way, because some of the way he acts towards her is very definitely, that's the way you'd see a not very nice bloke acting towards a girl kind of thing.
But it
read almost okay at the time, because it was a case of, well, he's not your typical muscle-bound default narrative bloke, so it can't be as bad. And she's seen him for what he really is. This is a Beauty and the Beast story, and yet it's not really like that.
Yeah, I do think that there's also this idea of it plays into that whole nice guy idea, and I do mean that in a very negative way. in the I'm a nice guy.
So why don't you XYZ, blah, blah, blah. And it's the whole idea with back to Edward Scissorhands is kind of like, well, I do love you, but my love will hurt you. In this case, it's a very obvious and literal metaphor. Because he ends up accidentally cutting her face.
Yeah.
And then you're looking at things then like Twilight.
Yeah.
Where, okay, you can't call him nervous or timid, but he falls in love with a girl he's got no business falling in love with, who he might well end up killing. So under the guise of being different and challenging and subverting a narrative, sometimes some stuff that we have not yet dealt with in the conversation about misogyny slips through, I think is my point on this one.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Basically, the lesson is, guys, just flesh your characters out.
Yeah, make them whole characters. And we're not saying they can't do shitty things. We're not saying you can't have a Manic Pixie Dream Girl-esque character who does a few shitty things and is a bit of a bitch. You know, give her motivation. And again, there's no reason you can't have a nervous, timid goth boy who has a bit of a chip on his shoulder and therefore perhaps doesn't treat certain other people who made it, you know, who represent people who made his life hell badly, but have him challenge it within the narrative. Okay, so for the last 5 minutes, we're going to talk about how these two tropes may or may not have shaped some of our own characters.
Okay. Well, I'm going to go ahead and start with the Manic Pixie Dream Girl.
Sure.
I'm obviously working on some other projects at the moment outside of the Hamartia cycle. With the Hamartia cycle, there was the whole situation with Faye and with Luca.
Yeah.
And in some ways, Luca is actually trying to be that Manic Pixie Dream Girl.
Yeah.
And that's an active decision on her part. She's trying to be able to fulfill this role because she's, in the first book, she's desperately in love with Rufus and she knows that he's hurting and she's kind of ignoring a lot of her own pain and she's, you know, she's a quirky character anyway and she wants to be everything for him. To the point that she kind of almost basically wants him to just treat her like she's her sister.
Yeah, I will pour myself into the mould and be the person you need me to be.
Exactly. And Rufus is the one who's saying, no, I don't want that. Whilst also being a little bit tempted because he's in so much pain. And that's the problem, is that she won't take no for an answer. And he is a little bit tempted because, you know, he does want that comfort, but she's the one who's very active in that. But in the end, it does end well in that basically she does sort of accept that it's not going to happen, and allows herself to become her own person. But whilst accepting the fact that, yeah, she was in love with Rufus at a time, and she still does care for him long afterwards to a huge, huge degree. Faye in the second book, very much is there for Rufus as well. She's the one who kind of is helping him, but I wouldn't call her a Manic Pixie Dream Girl because she definitely has her own agenda and her own problems and her own things. And she's also actually not there for quite a fair bit of his bullshit.
The other thing is she doesn't sort of mould herself to fit in around his bullshit and gently nudge him. She's more likely to crack him over the top of the head and say, stop being an idiot.
Exactly, yeah. Rufus is a tiny bit of a little bit of a goth boy.
Yeah, actually. I hadn't thought about it till you said it. And I'm like, oh no, actually he is. I could go with that. That's probably why I like him.
Yeah, probably is.
I seriously am a sucker for this character thinking about it.
Within the other things, I think Kestrel is the literal opposite of a Manic Pixie Dream Girl.
Yeah, and I have to say that feels like it was a very deliberate choice.
It was incredibly deliberate. And I think it was actually... The whole point of Kestrel was that when I started writing Kestrel, I was not in a very good place. So my mother had just been diagnosed with cancer. I was incredibly stressed, and there were lots of things going on in my life. And so I just started Kestrel as a little bit of fun. And I just suddenly went, I want to create a character who's like me, but is just unapologetically me, basically. Yeah. Who's not really that worried about anything else, who doesn't censor herself, who doesn't do anything like that. And once I started creating that character, of course she snowballed. And she very much became her own person. And it was definitely in that in some ways she is a bit manic, but she's not together. she's the literal opposite of together.
No, she's kind of a mess.
Yeah.
A lovable mess. But yeah.
And in some ways, Galahad is the manic pixie dream girl, quite literally. Because he's meant, his whole purpose is to fit whoever he's serving. And what's happening is that he's desperately trying to fit according to Kestrel. And Kestrel is constantly rejecting him, regardless of what happens. And his whole thing is that he goes through the first book with this whole struggle of actually finding, of discovering his own identity. You know, who is he? Is he even real? Is he even who he believes that he is? And so that's something which is constantly going on in his head as well, whilst he's desperately kind of trying to fit alongside Kestrel, who's just so chaotic that nothing will ever really fit.
yeah, definitely. Yeah, I agree with that. And it's a really interesting juxtaposition to do that, I think.
Thank you. What about you?
So, yeah, I've definitely got a nervous, timid goth boy in the form of Steve.
Oh, Steve. He's so sweet.
He was supposed to be initially just a character with a walk-on part in one short story. Mm-hmm. And then I was writing book 4 and I still hadn't released that short story. And I was kind of, he's perfect. He is the perfect person to turn up at this point and be really awkward and difficult and out there and trying to identify who he is himself and almost kind of an anti-Kieran. Not that I'm setting him up to be like another love interest, because he really wasn't. He was definitely a friend.
Yeah.
But in the sense of, if you've read Blood and Bone, you know that Steve's reaction to Kieran initially is really unfavourable.
Yeah.
And he's got quite a chip on his shoulder. And he doesn't treat Kieran that well initially either.
No, he doesn't. Until he kind of realises that Kieran isn't actually nearly as bad as he thinks.
No, he's made assumptions based on Kieran's appearance and his confidence and his ease of manner.
Yeah.
And, you know, people have always made assumptions about Steve and the way he wants to express himself. So, yeah, that was an interesting little foray into it. And I loved the character so much that obviously he's coming back in Amy's series, so I've done a few little scenes and things, and I love seeing the way his character has developed, because he is still very much this, you know, nervous, timid goth boy, but who just cannot help but wrestle with really complex questions of morality and will do things because he thinks they're right rather than because they're, you know, part of the default male narrative kind of thing.
Yeah.
So he's a great character to have in there, and I think he works as a perfect foil to Amy, who's a little ball of sunshine and energy but can be a little bit clueless on certain things.
I can really, really see how that would work, because Steve is a really interesting character, and he is quite dynamic, and I do like the way that you've done it, because on some levels he's meant to be a little bit irritating. Yeah. And that irritating side comes from this complete insecurity he has, where he acts overly pompous, really, to kind of buff up his own sense of intelligence and things like that. And the fact is that he is actually very intelligent. He's well read, and he's a really genuinely nice guy. And when he is put into a friendly environment, he relaxes. And that's when you really start to see him come through. But he is still quite shrewd in a lot of those ways. And because Amy is actually naturally a very popular character, because she has that warmth and that energy which attracts people to her.
Yeah.
you do actually get this nice dynamic. Weirdly enough, Amy, and sorry, this isn't a complaint or anything like that. Amy could almost sort of fit the manic pixie dream idea. Now, I'm not saying that that's her character at all, because it isn't. She's an incredibly three-dimensional character. I mean that she could very much be assigned that role by other people.
Yeah, definitely. Small, cute, pretty girl who is very independent and quite confident in what she wants. And if it didn't go any further than that, if she wasn't a total physics nerd, if she wasn't always calling people on their bullshit, but still being invested in her own life and that, yeah, you'd be right. It's a bit like Kelsey as well, actually.
Yeah, absolutely. And weirdly enough, in the first book, M almost treats Amy a little bit like a manic pixie dream girl character. And I don't mean that obviously in a romantic sense, that would be weird. I mean yeah, in the sense that she doesn't notice that there's something seriously wrong with Amy. She just kind of automatically assumes that everything's all right with Amy. And she does actually sort of go to Amy for comfort and things like that. And she does continue to go to Amy for comfort and gets a little bit annoyed in later books when Amy isn't necessarily paying attention. But I like that as well, because obviously it's not as simple as the manic pixie dream girl thing. But it's because Amy is also incredibly empathetic that it would be very easy for someone else to go, oh, that's what you're like. And yeah, to some degree, it's also what some people kind of do with M as well.
Yeah, definitely. It's one of those things where it's, if you do it right, you can use bits of the trope to have pushes and pulls between relationships. And nobody is a completely reliable narrator in their own story, because nobody is completely unbiased in their own life. So yeah, it's interesting to do it that way. So in some respects, M can be a little bit unreliable as narrator sometimes, because her perceptions are off the wall to everybody else's, and she can't help that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And you could say the same of Amy. So I'm really enjoying sort of playing around with Amy and Steve and Bex, who is another character in this particular series. I will just mention Melanie Beckett briefly, because obviously I'm working on that at the moment. She's someone who, on a first glance, you might look at her and go, ha, manic pixie dream girl. And then you actually get to know her and you think, oh my god, you're a little psychopath. Kind of thing. You're not a dream girl at all.
You're a nightmare.
And yeah, without giving any spoilers away, sort of her big seduction technique for Kestrel is nothing short of sociopathic, to be honest.
Wait. Jules, are we actually going to tell people about Kestrel?
Well, we have actually told them already that they have a thing at some point. And that's as far as we've...
Did we actually name them?
We did, yeah.
Oh, shit.
That's not a big reveal anymore, unfortunately.
Okay, that's fine.
But how it happens, we won't go into. But let's just say it's not a normal thing you do.
No, and yet it totally works. Kestrel's like, wait a second.
And yeah, you'll see that all the way through, because Melanie's big thing is being able to manipulate people into doing what she wants them to do. And she doesn't really do it cynically in a way to harm people, but she's quite good at reading people and getting what she wants.
Yeah.
And you know, you'll find out from her backstory and various other things why she's sort of grown crooked like that. But she is definitely not a white hat, so no. Definitely somewhere in the grey zone.
Kestrel just seems to really like people in the grey zone.
It makes sense, really. You've even got Melanie going, why do I always go for the good guys? Why do I always attracted to the good guys? This makes no sense.
I think we've come to the natural end of our episode now. I really, really am very interested in what the whole thing of the goth boy. It's going to change the way I read everything now. So thank you for introducing that. To our listeners, please do leave comments and tell us what you guys think about this. Do you agree with us? Do you disagree with us? Do you like the manic pixie girl dream? Do you dislike the goth boy? Or can you give us examples of where you've seen it in any kind of media at all? Before we go, it is time for our Dissecting Dragons recommendation. And this week, Jules, I believe you've got one for us.
I have. In fact, I could actually recommend the complete collected works of an entire publishing house because they've just been sending brilliant novellas and completely knocking it out of the park for me lately. So, you know what? Check out the work produced by Tor.com. But I'm specifically talking about an arc I got recently called Empress of Salt and Fortune. And I'm really sorry, I can't remember the author's name. It'll come back to me. Anyway, there aren't many other books called that, so just look it up. And it's this amazing sort of China fantasy world set novella that follows a main character who was kind of handmaiden to an empress. And when I say an empress, this girl was a political marriage to the emperor. And all he had to do was get her pregnant once. And once she's had a son, he takes the son away. And he has his men do something to her so that she can't ever have any children to challenge the narrative. And sends her into exile because they didn't really want her. And it's about the friendship between this servant, who's known as Rabbit, and this empress. And they call her the Empress of Salt and Fortune. And it actually turns out that she really is an empress in her own right. And it's subtle and it's clever and it's beautifully evoked and rich. And this is just really about silenced women's voices coming forward and claiming a place for themselves. I really can't praise this one highly enough. It's a really, really good book. Just go in, sounds give brilliant. It a couple of chapters and you'll love it. It's also, it's queer, it's non-binary, deals with an awful lot of women's issues in
that
general.
That sounds brilliant. Okay. I might have to check that out. And on that note, guys, we'll say thanks very much for listening and we'll catch you guys next week.
Yeah, thanks and goodbye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note, no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.